Michael Cathcart. You're very welcome to Books and Arts Daily here on RN. Today, the surprising and deep connections between Indigenous Australian writers and Dalit writers from India.
These are the two oldest storytelling traditions of the world, and they speak of certain common themes, like they speak of the environment, they speak of the earth as something that we have inherited rather than possessed.
And actor Miriam Margolyes reveals her favourite lady of opera.
She's ravishing. I've never met her, I've never been to a live concert, but her power and control over her voice is quite astonishing.
Talk is cheap, my darling.
And congratulations to Melbourne electronic musician Chet Faker, who we're just hearing here, and also to Adelaide-raised singer-songwriter Sia, who've been named Australia's Best Music Artists in the ARIA Awards. That was last night. And Chet Faker told the crowd at the ceremony last night that his high school teacher told him not to pursue a career in music. Just makes you feel better, doesn't it? Patrick Swayze's there carrying Jennifer Grey aloft in that lovely pink dress of hers. That scene is seared into the minds of the millions of people who have bopped along to the 1987 film Dirty Dancing. Well, the stage production of Dirty Dancing premiered in Australia back in 2004, and it's back for a 10th anniversary tour, and its director is James Powell, who joins me now. G'day, James.
G'day, good morning.
Put me down. Well done. So, it's been one of the most successful stage productions ever globally. Why? Why is it so popular?
It's a lot to do with obviously the film was a massive hit, and I think on lots of levels, really. But importantly, I think of its time, it was a less glossy, more grainy, realer sort of coming of age story that people could really attach themselves to, and. And, of course, I think the music has been, it's renowned and wonderful, and it has that really feel-good factor to it. So I think there are lots of elements, and it's, increasingly popular.
It occurs to me, James, as you listen to it, it's music you want to treat ironically because you're so sophisticated, but actually you just end up enjoying it.
Well, yes. It is, in spite of yourself.
Yeah, that's it. So in 25 words or less, what's the story?
Family holiday, girl meets boy, she's on holiday, he's a working class kid, she's an educated middle class girl, she steps in to help him dance, their frissons become a little more than a frisson as she learns to dance, and they end up sort of really appreciating each other. He gets framed for some theft, which he didn't do, he leaves, and he comes back at the end, and all is good.
So you've got this film, which is so popular and so loved, and you're turning it into a stage show. You could muck this up. Obviously, you haven't, because it's so popular. But what's the gig? How do you think through this task of taking something that's in one format, the film, and turning it onto the stage? So, I don't know. If it was too slavish, I guess that would be a downside as well.
It's a huge undertaking. And you know, with these things, you have so many people to let down. It's very difficult. You know, there are thousands of people who come and see the show that know every single line from the movie and every kind of iconic moment, every nuance. And, you know, you've really got to be detailed and on that. And, fortunately, we have Eleanor Bergstein, who's still around and still with us and still on our shoulders saying, no, this is how we should do it. That's how we should do it. So, you know, she is really knows this story and is in this story unbelievably so. So we have that. But, you know, the important thing is that you need to... Live is different to a movie, and you really need... You know, I always think the best way for this to happen is for the pulse of the show to keep moving and keep going so the audience are never waiting for anything to happen.
It tells you something about the power of live, doesn't it? Because we can all get the DVD and watch the movie as often as we like. And actually, you know, frankly, going out to a musical is an expensive way to spend an evening. So there is something galvanising about the the live performance. I wonder what that quality is.
Well, I don't know, but I always the exciting thing for me is the anticipation. You know, when somebody, I directed a O2 concert of Les Miserables for its 25th anniversary, and it was in London, and people have been fans of that show for that long length of time, and just the buzz prior to the first downbeat from the conductor was so palpable. It's unbelievable, but you know, and they just stay with it. It really is a different experience, and I can't explain it.
Mm. So your own background is as a performer, is that right? You started in musical theatre, did you, and then became a director?
Yeah, I was an actor. I was a young Welsh kid who went to a drama school in North London, and I could sing because I'm Welsh. And, and it's part of the curriculum.
Marvelous.
And yes, and yeah, and I found myself. I did a few plays when I first came out, and loved acting. And I sort of always had an eye for the sort of big picture of things. And when I wasn't acting, I would be a flyman, or I'd work on the wardrobe department, or box office, or you know. So I was always into theatre, and. And I sort of wanted to see how it all sort of came together. So, and really, I after I did a few plays and a film and some TV, I went then and joined the company of Les Miserables. And I sort of became, I guess, the only kind of analogy I can make is like if you're in a football team, I became the sort of captain of that football team. And then shortly afterwards, I became the coach. And
right. So then they let you direct a production of Les Miserables and so on. So in terms of directing, do you work with a more established director first, do you? Like, remounting their production and doing that kind of task first before they actually let you off the leash?
That's what happened to me in particular, yes. And, you know, so I was working for Trevor Nunn and John Caird and Sir Richard Eyre and, you know, so, and then... You know, I go out then and like an ambassador put up their shows all over the world.
Yeah, so that's how it works. We should just explain this. A production is directed by a big name director. It has a huge success in America or in England, and so we think, okay, this is a global export. And then more junior directors basically just remount the production, just teach people the moves, I guess.
Yeah, kind of. However, it's very collaborative. And you say to the more established director, don't you think this is a better idea?
Oh, do
and
you?
They go, yes, right. Go ahead, James. Thank you. Yeah. That'll add to my royalty.
And gradually people start to realise that you could probably do it on your own, and there you are. Now, look, I'm interested in what the difference between – I've always been interested in this. What's the difference between the commercial sector – and the subsidised theatre, the theatre that gets government support? Because on one side you've got a form of theatre that's hugely profitable if it goes well. On the other side you've got theatre that you expect to make a loss, and in which it will always be necessary for there to be top-up from government or sponsors or philanthropists and so on. Can you put into words what you think the difference is between those two sectors?
That's difficult. I mean, you know, subsidised theatre, certainly in my country, is becoming more and more reduced. And, you know, so they're now forced to do sort of four-handers because they're the most affordable. And you don't get, huge budgets and big sets and all of that for them to work in. Whereas, you know, in the commercial world, what they do is reduce the amount of time you have to do something. But... there's a lot of investment and a lot of money put there.
Mm.
But also I think, you know, also that it's a less of a gamble. You know, in the commercial world, I think they need a surefire, you know, success. Whereas I guess in the subsidized world, you can really get interesting art forms and work it and workshop it. And from there, hopefully that becomes a hotbed and a breeding ground for better and more interesting and more diverse, certainly theatre, in my
guess. Well, it's about risk, isn't it?
Yeah,
in the
I
end.
Think so.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. I'm talking to James Powell, who's a theatre director, a commercial theatre director, director of very successful musicals. My wife worked on a musical or a project for a musical in Hollywood that in the end didn't see the light of day. But she came back with a story that in the workshops when they're all together trying to work out how to make it work, they kept talking about the ticket buyer from Baltimore. And the producer would say, no, Hanny, the theatre ticket from Baltimore doesn't want to see that. Have you had that experience of this kind of archetypal audience member who you're trying to second guess?
Yes. What do they call them in New York? Bridge and Tunnel. You know, so they're the guys from, like, New Jersey who come to, you know, support your show on Broadway. And so you have to give them what they want. And that's a sort of, you know, that's your litmus test. That's what you're aiming for. And anything beyond and above that is approved.
Well, I've got a brilliant idea. I reckon this is going to appeal to these people.
Yes.
This idea is that we're going to do, you and I, Oedipus Rex, the musical.
Okay.
Okay, so this is the idea. We tell the story of Oedipus Rex and all of its gory glory, and we take established songs.
Yes.
You know, we work on the principle that Dirty Dancing does, that we want people to know the tunes.
Yes.
So I've got one here. This is Peaches with Mummy Complex. Hush now, baby, don't you stress. I'm gonna feel your mom the complex. Hush now, baby, don't you stress. I'm gonna feel your mom the complex. Hush now, baby. That's not a crowd pleaser, is it, that one?
Well, I think so. I like the mixture of the sort of classic and the contemporary you've done there, Michael, which I think is a surefire success.
Okay, I see. Edgy, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
What about this
I'm
one?
Just trying to finish off the narrator's first line, you know. Oedipus Rex and his mother had a very interesting relationship.
Yeah.
Do you get it?
Yeah, that's it. And then we hit Peaches with Mummy Complex. This is sweeter. This is Sun Kill Moon.
I can live with the sky falling out from above. I can live with your scorn, your sourness, your smug. I can live growing old alone if push comes to shove. But I can't live without my mother's love.
Yeah, I can't live without my mother's love. That's a showstopper, isn't it?
You know, it's so worrying that you've really thought about this.
I really have. We workshopped it this morning in the office. Actually, we haven't really thought about it. With 15 minutes to go, I suddenly said, I've got a great idea, everyone. We're going to do Oedipus Rex, the musical. Ring the library. Everybody was coming up with ideas. Got one more. Ozzy Osbourne's got a song that we're working this as well.
Times have changed and times are strange. Here I come, but I ain't the same. Mama, I'm coming home.
So look out. I mean, that's good, isn't it? Times
Fantastic.
Have changed. Times are strange. I mean, it totally fits.
Yes.
So what do you reckon?
Oh, it's a surefire hit. Keep going.
Got any other ideas? What other?
Yes. You know, My Eyes Adored You. Ma, You're Making Eyes at Me. There's a few there. You know, I think you should open up to the broader audience for suggestions.
Well, let's do that. Let's go onto Twitter. We're at RN Books and Arts. If you've got a brilliant idea for a song or songs that will work in Oedipus the musical, and you sign over the idea to me, I'm not going to share the royalties with the great Radio National family, much as I love you all. We're all looking after ourselves in these unhappy times. Will you direct it for me?
Oh, of course.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
Okay,
yeah,
you're
sure.
On.
Or better still, get somebody more established and then I'll just come in and take it around the world for you.
No, we'll take a risk. You and I, we're risk takers. We're going
like
to bring the
that,
two
Mike.
Sectors together, the risk and the commercial chutzpah. Now, honestly, do you reckon we could get this off the ground? Or is this highlighting something about the difference between the commercial field and the what the legit theatre, as it's sometimes called?
No, I think that musicals are written by the kind of oddest, strangest, weirdest. You know, who'd have ever thought that a musical about lots of French people dying would be a huge hit? But, you know, it's probably the most successful musical in the world. And yet, if you were to propose that to a board of people who are there to sort of invest in it and believe in it, I think they'd all go, you're crazy.
We've got one text.
You know, and what about,
can I just
yes,
read
ahead,
you this text?
Go ahead.
It says, this is Diane. She says, I want to complain about Michael Cathcart. That's me. He has way too much fun presenting Books and Arts Daily.
This is a very serious,
I'm sorry.
You know, highbrow.
I'm sorry.
Yes, for goodness sake.
We'll get highbrow a bit later on. We always get highbrow.
Yes.
I don't know.
How marvellous. Well, what's the next project? Have you got another idea, apart from Oedipus the musical, have you got another gig to go to?
I've got some casting to do for Les Miserables in New York. I leave actually on Sunday to do that. And then I've got a huge event called Christmas for my wife and my two kids back in the UK.
That'll be big.
Yes. And I can't wait. And you know what? I've got some time then. And you know, increasingly I'm more drawn. Well, I've got a local little group where kids from all different backgrounds and schools come in, and I go and help out there with these guys. And they, you know, they pay 50p and come and have some drama workshops and all of that. And I love doing that.
Yeah.
So that's sort of becoming an increasingly growing passion of mine.
Many years ago I directed the local primary school play, and remains the thing I've enjoyed doing most in my life.
Yeah, it's so rewarding.
Mm.
And you know, and I a lot of the shows I've done have had children in them. You know, I did Mary Poppins, you've got Michael and Jane Banks, and you have various sets of those kids. And the most fantastic thing is to sort of plant the seed and just watch them develop and grow, and their confidence, and you know, I mean, it's just incredibly rewarding. I really have a soft spot for all of that.
It's been good to meet you, James. Thanks for coming in and being such a good sport.
Thanks, Michael, and good luck with your musical.
Thank you so much. James Powell is the director of the hugely popular stage production of Dirty Dancing, which is on its 10th anniversary tour. It opens in Sydney tomorrow night and then tours to Melbourne and Brisbane. There are details on our website. This is Books and Arts Daily on RN.
Desperado? What does it mean?
It means I'm desperate for you, Monica. It's like blasting along a highway going like 90, 100 miles an hour. Sometimes just dip in the road to suck your guts out. Breath is gone. That's me around you, Shane. That's me. Breathless.
Impatient youths of the sun, burning with many colors. Flick combs through hair in bathroom mirrors.
Love Sounds. Masha Tupitskin is a American multimedia artist who's created a work using love scenes in cinema. Now, Books and Arts Daily has been looking at the review of the National Education Curriculum. This is on the arts subjects and their role in the national curriculum over the past few weeks. And one of the areas that the reviewer struck out of the original blueprint is media arts. So the national curriculum originally said media arts were going to be part of the compulsory curriculum for kids, you know, at junior school and so on. Now that's not going to happen. The review says that media arts should just be incorporated into other core subjects like English. And it says there's sort of confusion about what media arts comprises, what the definition of this is. Well, perhaps some clarity can be gained from a new exhibition. Jonathan Parsons is the artistic director of the 6th International Biennial of Media Art. It opens tomorrow in Melbourne before touring to other regions. Good morning.
Good morning.
Oedipus Rex, it's a good idea, isn't it?
It's a fabulous idea. I'm really looking forward to seeing that premiering at the Arts Centre.
Yeah.
Have you already spoken to them about that?
Yeah, no, but I'm expecting them to be on the phone after we get off
indeed,
air.
Indeed. I'm surprised they're not ringing right now.
I'll be signing it up. We can have a media arts dimension. Okay, let's build the media arts dimension into Oedipus Rex. What is media arts? How do we bring that into this concept?
Well, media arts, the birth of media arts came out of the personal computer. So with the personal computer and the processing power of the personal computer, suddenly that created all these new forms and possibilities for artists in terms of integrating different kind of forms. So there's a sensational work in experimental recharge by Khaled Sabsabi, who's a Sydney-based artist, called 70,000 Veils. And it's 100 screens set up like a book on its side. And he's used, each of the screens has 700 images, and they're cycling at 700 seconds. And so it's a completely immersive experience.
Right.
Now, that wasn't possible 20 years ago. So that's the kind of opportunities that were presented by the birth of the personal computer.
I guess that's right. The computer just does invite you to experiment because you keep discovering all these neat things it can do.
That's right.
I mean, I can remember when I first got a computer and there was the simple program Paintbox, which simply let you draw some lines and colour them in.
Yep.
I spent hours doing that.
Yeah. Well, that's right. And And I guess, you know, we used to talk about new media art, and of course, you know, it's now, what is it, well over 20 years. It was the late 80s that the personal computer was invented.
And so started. You're showing your age if you say new media art.
You are. But the thing is, it's not that the new has completely disappeared, because as we know, the technology keeps changing. So, you know, I expect we'll probably see in the next couple of years a lot of works using Oculus Rift, which is the, you know, 3D headset.
Oculus Rift?
Yeah.
Well, sounds like a character from Harry Potter.
Well, indeed. And I think, you know, it's quite possible that, you know, you won't actually have to go into the gallery space at all. You can just have your Oculus Rift headset on and walk through the whole gallery at home. So, you know, we'll see. So there's a bit of new still in there. Yeah. But I guess the other thing is, the reason we've dropped new media art is that it's not all new now. It's 20 years old.
But we do keep adding new at the front end.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get sort of, you know, get the talk right. So the back end, that's getting old. But the front end, the new media keeps...
It keeps coming along. So, you know, there's a wonderful work by some local artists called Cake Industries who's basically thinking about what is the 21st century version of portraiture. And they were particularly thinking about how that whole long tradition of portraiture, which is, you know, there was a whole ritual associated with it, there was a whole importance, you know, particularly of the, you know, the grand masters painting, you know, the portrait. Well, digital cameras don't really capture that same sense of value and importance. So they were thinking about, well, what would be the 21st century version of that? 3D printing. So they've invited 15 of their community in Melbourne, to represent their community in Melbourne, to come and have their faces, heads scanned, and they've outputted it through a 3D printing, and that's installed in these beautiful frames, and they're revolving, lit in these frames in the exhibition. So that was their answer to that idea of what might be a contemporary form.
Now, it occurs to me as you're talking that on the one hand, the personal computer is something which anyone in the West can aspire to own.
Yeah.
Well, not anybody. It's like saying poor people don't drive cars or whatever the thing is. But, you know, people can aspire to own. We've got access to it in the modern world. And yet the kind of media art we're talking about still can have a patina of the esoteric about it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think, look, one of the things, and this is one of the things that I love about media arts, is that it's incredibly eclectic, and particularly as the technology keeps changing. You see everything from robotics to screen-based conceptual art, playful interactive works. We've got a fabulous couple of works by Neyza Franco, a Brazilian artist. One's called Paranoia, and it's activated when you come just about, you know, a foot away from the device, and it's a mouth, and it screams at you. So that should be quite surprising in the gallery as people walk past some beautiful conceptual works, and then suddenly this face is screaming at you.
It's a little bit of carnival.
That's right. It's a little bit.
Fairground trick.
Absolutely, absolutely. But it's a delightful work and a surprising work. So, you get the whole gamut, really. There's a beautiful conceptual work, actually, from the Netherlands called Score Codex. And they actually wanted to document this arts organisation that was defunded in Holland in 2013 with the massive budget cuts to the arts there. And so they were thinking, well, what is the thing that's going to document this this history of this extraordinary arts organisation? And they came back to the book. So it's printed in the book is all this code, which is basically the website of this organisation, but they decided that the most stable way that had the best chance of longevity was actually the book, because there's 21 Gutenberg Bibles still in existence in the world, and there are no examples of the first websites.
Right.
So, you know, that's a beautiful conceptual piece, you know, that talks about some of the kind of issues that you see in this digital age. And we've certainly picked up that theme through the exhibition as well.
I hope it's printed on acid-free paper.
Well, indeed, absolutely. Mm. So, you know, and there's a real interest actually in archiving coming out and different ways of archiving, because of that issue of whether this culture that is all around us, we're even going to have access to in, you know, 20 or 30 years.
Jonathan Parsons is with me this morning. He's the artistic director of the 6th International Biennial of Media Art, which opens tomorrow in Melbourne and then tours off to other regions. So there's also some work by the German sound artist Korinsky Collective, which it's got something to do with a big bang. Just explain to what this. We've got some audio of this, but tell us first what this is.
Well, the inspiration behind it was that there was a recently from scientists from the Smithsonian Institute in America announced that they had documented evidence of sound waves from the origins of the universe. So this got these artists thinking, well, what would it mean if all of the sounds of the past and present that are still in existence today? So it's an atmospheric, well, as you'll hear from the sound piece, it's an atmospheric piece to give that sense.
Just sounds like a lot of noise.
But, you know, you feel it in your whole body. You go into the space and you actually feel this depth, this sort of history, this, you know, everything surrounding you. It's, again, a very immersive feeling.
And so then it's a ribcage experience.
It's a ribcage experience. And then there's a break for 3 seconds because scientists have determined that actually for humans, one's sense of the present, as in you're not thinking about the past or the future, only lasts for 3 seconds. So he has
Can you say that again? Because 3 seconds have passed and I've lost your point.
Yeah, so we're only capable of being in the present for 3 seconds before it suddenly, it's something, you know, you feel like you're in the past. So he's broken the sound piece in these 3 second gaps to give that sense. And then the whole universe opens up with this rich, immersive sound system that, you know, you feel through your whole body. You feel like all the sounds of the whole of history are here. It's quite an amazing piece.
I just don't understand that. You think we're kind of on hold for 3 seconds and then it slips away from you.
It's just that sense of between what your actual presence, you know, your sense of presence only lasts, you know, you're in the present only for 3 seconds before whatever you're doing becomes
yesterday. I'm spilling my cup of tea becomes I've spilt my cup of
tea. Exactly.
That's a 3 minute gap.
3 second.
3 seconds. Sorry, three seconds.
It's only 3 seconds.
Concentrate, Michael. Three seconds.
Yeah, 3 seconds. 3 minutes. That would be extraordinary.
Right. Now, I'm on the hunt for grand statements that I don't think mean anything. So I'm throwing down a challenge to you, Jonathan.
Yeah.
One of the grand statements that define this exhibition is this.
Yep.
You ask, can an artwork lead us to new modes of consciousness?
Yep.
I thought, is that just art patter or is he saying something profound?
Well, look, you know, the title of the exhibition, Recharge, we were looking at two things here. We were looking at the role of artists, the role that artists play, which I think is... It's very much that they can... You know, they have the ability to change your understanding of the world and knowledge systems and meaning systems. And sometimes that's refreshing them and sometimes that's radically transforming them. So Junker Billy Atkins has got this incredible animation called Cannibal Story. He's a Matu elder from Western Australia. And he's painted... This is his first time that he's done animation. And he's done a lot of painting, and it's one of his stories about cannibals at Lake Disappointment in Western Australia. And to me, that's a great example of an artist refreshing a tradition by transforming what was an oral tradition into a painting and now into animation. And in 6 minutes, you get this, and it speaks to a whole new generation of audiences. So that's a way of refreshing. You know, when I talked before about cake industries, that to me is completely changing the idea of portraiture because it's, you know, it's turned it into a 3D, you know, spinning.
Right.
And Svenja Kratz, who has got this beautiful installation she's got the DNA of an 11-year-old girl whose SOS2 cell line was extracted from her cancer lesion in 1973. And that has been used in laboratories across the globe, you know, in research laboratories. There's now more of her DNA in the world than was ever in that 11-year-old girl in 1973. So that's really changes your idea of time, of, you know, a portraiture.
And it's profound, isn't it?
And it's profound.
Yeah.
And it's quite it's an uncanny work, really.
Mm. So I'll ask you the sentence again. Can an artwork lead to new modes of consciousness? Well, that work does.
That work absolutely speaks to that.
Fills that. All right.
You know, we
you get a tick.
Thanks. I passed. Did I pass?
I've asked you the hard question.
Did I pass?
Held you accountable, which is what the ABC is here to do.
Good on you.
And I think you got by. So this thing's going on tour. It's on in the. It's doing the capitals, and then it's doing the regions. Is it?
Yeah, it'll be touring for 18 months. So we head off to Mildura after we close here in Melbourne on the 21st of February, and then we head off to Mildura, and we're going to tour through Victoria, New South Wales, and Queensland. So it's the only biennial that tours, actually, and I think that's really, you know, important, because a lot of, particularly people outside of the main cities, don't get to see this kind of work.
Yeah.
So it's actually been a really wonderful thing for us.
Just as we wind up, how do you fund the tour? Is there government support for regional tours?
Yep, we get support from all three levels of funding and also sponsors. So certainly Visions Australia have been very supportive in terms of supporting our tours, because they recognise that, you know, the value of bringing this kind of work out into the regions.
Visions Australia might be good for Oedipus Rex.
Well, yes, indeed.
Thank you.
Yeah, I might leave you to that one.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming in. Jonathan Parsons, the Artistic Director of Experimenta Recharge. It's the 6th International Biennial of Media Art. It opens tomorrow in Melbourne, and then it tours through the new year. And the details of that exhibition, where it will be all over Australia, they're on our website. And on RN Drive, Waleed Ali will be featuring some of the artists in the coming days. I believe they'll be talking robotics, so do look out for that. On RN, this is Books and Arts Daily. Next up, Indian and Aboriginal writers finding common ground. Well, Indigenous writers Ellen van Nieuwen, Anita Heiss, and Alexis Wright, all of whom we've spoken to here on Books and Arts, are about to head off to India over the next few months. And they're not alone. There's a whole collection of Aboriginal writers who are travelling to festivals and universities and other cultural writing events. In fact, some of them have already started on this marvellous journey. But why are they going to India? What are they doing there? Well, this is part of a special project that's been initiated by literary academic Dr. Miradula Chakraborty, who is from the University of Western Sydney, and she joins us now to explain this Literary Commons project. Welcome, Miradula. Nice to have you here.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be back on the program.
So how did all this begin?
All this began in 2012 when I had organized a similar gathering of writers called the Australia-India Literatures International Forum, where I had brought 12 Indian writers to be in conversation with 24 Australian writers at the State Library of New South Wales. And my intention there was to draw some attention to the vibrant literatures that exist in the 22 regional Indian languages. We know that Indian literature in English has a spectacular presence on the global arena. But literatures from these 22 different Indian languages, which are extremely vibrant and in some cases have 2,000-year-old traditions, have not really gained that kind of exposure in the world. So in 2012, this was my intention, and our inaugural panel was between two Dalit writers from two regional languages, Marathi and Telugu, and two indigenous Australian writers. And we found that the connections, the writer-to-writer connections, the kind of commonalities that they shared in terms of the literary practices, the dissemination of the voices was the strongest.
Mm.
So starting from 2012, this is where we have gone ahead.
So you just used that word Dalit. Perhaps you could explain what that means. What does Dalit mean?
The word Dalit means downtrodden, and it was a word used for a certain constituency of people who were on the lowermost rung of the caste hierarchy in India. But in the 1960s, the Dalit people, the downtrodden people, they reclaimed the word Dalit for themselves as a great slogan of liberation. They took upon themselves, and most of it was practitioners of literature, Dalit writers took it upon themselves to work for social reform, to work and give a voice to their people, to fight for their identity, and to make different kinds of literary innovations possible within the languages in which they were writing. So the Dalit literary renaissance has been one of the most significant developments in literature in India in the last 30 years.
So the Dalit are the people who used to be called the untouchables, are they?
At one point of time, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's a term that's not used now, I gather.
No.
But, you know, we all grew up knowing that there was this term in the caste system, these people who were known by that word. So the Dalit is the word we need to internalise. So you see these connections, do you, between Dalit literature and the way Indigenous authors, Australian Indigenous authors write? What's the common ground there?
One is in terms of the chronology itself. It's a very simple point that in the last 30 years, Indigenous literatures in Australia have burst upon the literary scene with their imagination, with their innovation, the kinds of stories that they're telling. And the same has happened in the literature, as I said, in the last 30 years. But more than that, there are old traditions. These are the two oldest storytelling traditions of the world. And they speak of certain common themes, like they speak of the environment, they speak of the earth, they speak of the earth as something that we have inherited rather than possessed. The storytelling traditions, which are grounded in oral literature, that is something that they share in common. And as both of these constituencies have joined the march of modernity, they have adapted themselves to tell new stories. And now they tell the stories of contemporary India and contemporary Australia in ways that are very different from what other storytellers are doing.
I suppose it's possible too that Aboriginal Australians came from India before the Great Migration of 40,000 years ago.
That's one of the things that is told about the myth of the Gondwana land when Australia and India were geographically attached. That is something that has not been conclusively proven. Indians do believe that Indigenous people in Australia are part of their the old relatives. In fact, one of the participants in this project talked about how when she went to India about 10 years ago, she was welcomed like a long-lost relative.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yes.
So back when in the ice ages, when the sea level was now how does this work? The sea level had dropped. That's right, and it was possible to walk from Asia down into Australia, perhaps covering small areas of sea by canoe. Yeah, it's possible that the Aborigines came from the what we now call India. So who are some of the go on.
Or that. The Indigenous people in India came from Australia.
Oh, well, the travel might have gone the other way. Well, that's a fascinating option. I'd never thought of that. All right. So how did you decide which of the Australian writers you were going to take to India? How did you choose?
This was in consultation with the First Nations Australia Writers Network that had it's an advocacy group for Indigenous writing. And this was inaugurated at the Adelaide Writers Week in April earlier this year. And Kathy Craigie, who is the executive director of the First Nations Australia Writers Network, and I got talking. And she's the one who had gone to India many years ago. And this is the kind of reception she got. And she immediately understood the impact of what I was trying to get through, that there is this deep commonality of cultures, traditions, storytellings, practices, beliefs between Indigenous people in Australia and Indigenous people in India, and that the literature, contemporary literature, was trying to get across those stories. And so we sat down, we thought, we brainstormed and came up with this list of a dozen writers.
This is an absolutely fantastic idea. This is Books Nuts Daily on RN, and we're talking to Dr. Miradula Chakraborty, who is an academic, a literary academic at the University of Western Sydney, who's taking Indigenous writers to India. So there's an exchange of writers, Indigenous writers from Australia with Dalit writers from India. And are you bringing some of the Indian writers back to Australia?
This is what we want to do at the moment. We're looking for funding. So next year, we hope that the kind of legendary hospitality that Indigenous writers receive in India this year, I hope that Australia can reciprocate next year by bringing 12 Dalit writers to Australia.
There you are. The hospitable Indians have thrown down the challenge. We have to hospitably welcome writers back here. The challenge is on. So this has got a marvellous name, Literary Commons. So when you bring these people together, what sort of events are you staging? Are they just getting around having lunch together, or are there big public events? What goes on?
The easiest form of engagement to begin with was through the literary festivals. India at the moment has at least 10 literary festivals which are of different sizes. The Jaipur Literature Festival is the largest one. It's one of the 6 most important literary festivals in the world at the moment. It's completely free. That is its distinctive feature as well. And then you have something as small as the Goa Literature Festival, which is a boutique festival, but it's run completely by volunteers. And they're extremely engaged, and they read each and every piece of work of the writers that come through the festival. So it was a matter of drawing up a schedule, and it was a matter of choosing which festivals we would like to showcase our writers at. So at the Goa Literature Festival, Australia is the focus country, and we have 5 writers out of the 12 that are going. So it was really a matter of choosing between these literary festivals. And once people in India who have some knowledge of indigenous literature got to know that we were bringing indigenous writers to India, they completely got excited, and they organized these events, usually in university spaces, because one of the ways in which literature gets disseminated in India is through university curriculum. And there they have welcomed the writers, put on a tremendous show for them in terms of a 2-day symposium or a 1-day event where the general public comes to gets to come and meet these writers and also present papers on their work. So interest is really, really high in India.
Well, you say interest is high. Are the writings of Australian Indigenous writers available to Indian readers? Are they published in India?
No, they're not published in India, and that's one of the things that Literary Commons aims to do. We have put together publishers from India who will bring out imprints of Australian books in India. Till the 1970s, Australian literature was, or Indigenous Australian literature was available in India, and it was taught at universities, mainly under the rubric of Commonwealth literature and new literatures, as it used to be called. So literatures from Canada, literatures from Australia, the Caribbean, etc., were taught in universities there. But after the 1970s, there was a kind of slowdown, and you'll find many people knowing intimately about the works of Sally Morgan or Ujuru, Kevin Gilbert. These are the people who are very familiar to the older scholars. What has happened now is the tradition has continued and people want to know more, but the availability of Australian literature in India is very low, and also Australian books, if they are available at all, are expensive. So one of the aims of Literary Commons is to A, make English imprints of Australian Indigenous literature available in India, and 2, is also to make available the work of Indigenous writers in translation. Because as I said to you, India has 22 languages, thriving literary traditions in each of those languages. And what we want to do is have translation programs and workshops through which the work of Indigenous writers can be translated into Indian languages.
Miradulla, I've been wondering recently whether there isn't an expanded role for the Australia Council for the Arts here, whether we shouldn't be looking to the Australia Council to promote Australian culture overseas. Do you think that would be a practical way to go forward?
The Australia Council has been absolutely fabulous in terms of supporting each and every one of these initiatives. My initiative in 2012, the Australia-India Literatures International Forum, was largely supported by the Australia Council. Then last year, I took Ali Kobi Eckerman, the Noongar poet, to Calcutta to get 40 of her poems translated into Bengali, which is one of the 6th most spoken languages of the world. And the first Asian Nobel laureate came out of that language. So Ali Kobi Eckerman's work has been translated into Bengali now, and these are the kinds of initiatives that we are looking at in different languages. When we went to Bangalore last month, 6 different translations of Indigenous writing were made available in the Kannada language, which is the language spoken in that state. But I agree that translation is a great way of reaching the vibrant reading audience in India, and the Australia Council has been supportive, and I'm hoping that they will be even more supportive. And there are other funding bodies which I'm sure, when they know about the scope of this program, can easily come in and say, yes, this is an initiative we'd like to honour and support.
Well, it does sound very, very exciting. Now, I want to ask your advice before you go. Mm-hmm. Next year, you may know, here on Books and Arts Daily, we're going to have a book club that's devoted to writings from the subcontinent. We'll have writings from India and from Pakistan and from other writers in that region, or from people who grew up there and have gone off to live somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered whether you could help us think our way into this project. So our first book in February is going to be The God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy, and then we're going to look at a Rohinton mystery book, A Fine Balance. Mm-hmm. So just thinking about perhaps The God of Small Things, as we begin to read that, how would we think our way into this kind of a literary experience?
Well, The God of Small Things is a very wonderful example of a piece of writing in Indian English, and Arundhati Roy undertakes a lot of experimentation with the English language. But the central plot in The God of Small Things is about a Dalit figure. So this is a writing that is coming out of Kerala, where the language is Malayalam. And Malayalam is, again, an extremely vibrant language. So what Arundhati Roy is doing is telling basically a Malayalam story, a story of Kerala in English, but the central character is a Dalit figure. The central character, the central plot of that story is a forbidden love between an upper caste Christian woman, which is one of the contradictions of how caste operates in India, and a Dalit man, and how this has ramifications for society. So one of the ways of thinking through literatures in India is to categorize them, A, according to Indian English written in India, which is a burgeoning market, it's booming. Two, diasporic writing coming out of the Indian subcontinent, that is people who grew up in the various countries, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Nepal, and now are living outside of those countries, mainly in the first world, and they're writing there. But also absolutely exciting, cutting-edge writing coming out of India at the moment, and the subcontinent is writing in the regional languages. And they tell a very different story of these different countries that are part of rising Asia at the moment.
Well, Miradulla, it would be marvellous to catch up with you again next year and perhaps to talk about some of those writers, perhaps not as part of the book club because we've already got those titles sorted out, but to introduce listeners who I'm sure are going to get, you know, very, very into India in the coming year to that broader dimension of the writing. Would you be part of that?
Absolutely. It would be a delight to bring these really vibrant and innovative writers to the attention of the larger global reading audience.
All right. Put that in your diary. We've made a date.
Thank you, Michael.
And all the very best with this project, the Literary Commons. When do you head off? When's the next consignment of Aussies heading off to India?
Next week.
Oh, well, bon voyage.
Thank you very much.
And we'll put this project, the Literary Commons, as it's called, we'll come back to it, I mean, we'll follow up on it, the Literary Commons, in a couple of weeks, and then we'll catch up again with them after the Jaipur Literary Festival, which is early next year. So Literary Commons is a creative partnership with the Asia Project. It's curated by Miradulla Chakraborty, my guest this morning, and is presented by the Writing and Society Research Centre at the University of Western Sydney and funded, as Miradulla said, by the Australia Council. And there are links to that on our homepage. And don't forget the Subcontinent Book Club. The links there is there as well on the Books and Arts homepage. You can look at the books that we'll be reading over the coming year. Next up, Miriam Margolyes.
In part three of Love in the 90s, Into the Music explores one of the least understood music movements.
Britpop. Blur took the cultural colonisation of Britain seriously in a war of liberation to reclaim British pop culture for Britain.
Oasis are being hyped as the best band.
Today is gonna be the day that they're gonna throw it back to you.
Blur, Oasis and Suede feature on Love in the 90s.
Offering much needed relief from grunge miserabilism.
Saturday from 4.
Right here on RN, where it's time now for Top Shelf. Now, imagine if you'd been born an Albanian. That was the question posed during a chat about the importance of English literature. The person to whom the question was directed was not amused. It was the Queen at Buckingham Palace during British Book Week. The poser of the question was the BAFTA award-winning actor Miriam Margolyes. We like to call her our own Miriam Margolyes because she's now an Australian citizen, attracted here, she says, by our irreverence and our energy. So it won't surprise you that for our Top Shelf segment, Miriam reveals a variety of favourites.
I want to start with my favourite book, which is Little Dorrit by Charles Dickens. It's a dark, late novel of his, full of the most extraordinary characters, a powerful moral story. I read it first, 40 years ago, and I have never stopped reading it. It's brilliant, so everybody, go and read it, Little Dorrit. My favourite picture, I think, is... I have two, really, which I would desperately want to see all the time. One is Bruegel's The Fall of Icarus. And in the very corner of the picture, and it's a vast landscape, you see a body just disappearing into the sea when the sun melts the wings of Icarus. And it's heartrending and extraordinary. And Bruegel is, he is a painter of real life, of people. So all around you see the life going on and the extinction of this one character. And the other picture that I love is The Portrait of Gertrude Stein by Pablo Picasso, which he painted in about 1904. And it shows her, this rather complicated, gay, famous writer, although she wasn't that famous at that time, sitting thoughtfully, resting one elbow on a knee in her signature kaftan, this brooding, friendly, leonine head. And I played Gertrude Stein many years ago, and I just love that picture. A sweet story about it, when it was taken away after Picasso's had painted it, and he'd given it to the Steins and her lover, Alice Toklas. And when Gertrude died, it was collected for the Metropolitan Museum, where it now is. And Alice said to Pablo Picasso, "Do you want to come and say goodbye to the picture?" And he came to their house and he saluted it. He waved it goodbye, one of the great pictures that he'd ever painted. And I suppose I would have to have a bit of theatre. And rather naughtily, I'm choosing quite a frivolous piece in a way. But it's the famous scene from Private Lives of Gertrude Lawrence and Noel Coward talking about when they first met. The most romantic and gentle, very gossamer-like piece of theatre. But it resonates through the ages. Brilliant timing, brilliant diction, great focus. These are things to admire.
You always had a sweet voice, Amanda. What exactly were you remembering at that moment?
Lots of things.
So was I.
What fools we were to ruin it all. What utter, utter fools.
We were so ridiculously over in love.
Yes. And yet, here we are starting off with two quite different people, in love all over again, aren't we? Aren't we?
No.
Elliot.
We're not in love all over again, and you know it. Good night, Amanda.
Oh, Elliot, don't leave me.
And for music, I think anything that Cecilia Bartoli sings, she's an Italian mezzo-soprano. She's ravishing. I've never met her, I've never been to a live concert, but her power and control over her voice is quite astonishing. That's my offering.
Cecilia Bartoli singing a Vivaldi opera there, and Miriam Margolyes is currently performing her solo show. It's called I'll Eat You. It's written by John Logan. It's about a voracious theatrical agent. It's at the Fairfax Studio in Melbourne until the 20th of December, and details are on our website. Well, that's the show for today. Tomorrow is the second last book of the European Classics Book Club. We're talking about The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco. So this is the last day to submit your comments or questions on the book for our discussion tomorrow. Just go along to our homepage and you can be part of the conversation. And you might like to watch the movie tonight with Sean Connery. I haven't watched it yet. I thought I might watch it tonight. So that's a way of looking at it. But Bush Telly's coming up. Are we crossing to Bush, Telly?
Yeah, yes. I'm here, Mike.
Oh, go for it.
We're almost going into your territory today. We're talking writing, rural writers in particular, and we'll hear the argument that given Australia's becoming an increasingly urbanised country, that it's getting more and more important to hear the rural voice in literature, and that there's a bit of a resurgence going on in rural writing. So some books and arts territory on Bush Telegraph today, and we're also looking at crowdfunding of conservation projects, trying to save endangered species with the help of crowdfunding. It's a big growing sector around the world at the moment.
Sounds good. That's coming up straight after the news. Let's go out with Chet Faker.
Said, help me help you start it. You're too comfortable to know. Throwing out those words, no, you gotta feel it on your own. Talk is cheap, my darling, when you're feeling right at home. I wanna be with you alone.
This is big. In fact, this is bigger than big. This is the moment we've all been waiting for. Yes, grand final day on the Sunday Extra podcast. The Clash of Titans, a war of words. Our mini debate series reached its climax. Geraldine Quinn, Casey Bonetto wrestle it out. One last dose of fatal rhetoric, the On the Contrary Grand Final. Join me, Jonathan Green. You can stream or download the program from the RN website.